Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Killer Frogs, the podcast all about TCU athletics from the fans' point of view. My name is Sean Fouché, and this is episode 199. We're almost at 200 of these things for October 27th, 2023. And to my right on tonight's podcast, we've got TCU former player Nathan Hernandez. How you doing, Nathan?
You know, I made it today, so I'm happy.
Well, cheerful as always, Nathan. Really appreciate that. Also joining us from TCU Fan Nation and KillerFrogs.com, we've got Barry Lewis. How you doing, Barry?
Doing well. Good seeing you.
Well, let's just go ahead and jump into this week. Barry, let's talk basketball. So you just got back from the Big 12 tip-off, where we were, you know, the media got the chance to meet the men's and women basketball team. How did that event go?
It was a great event. Really got to talk to some of the players and see what they're looking forward with the season. It was interesting to me that on the men's side, Coach Dixon brought three of the returning players. It was Emmanuel Miller, Jacoby Coles, and Micah Peavy. And then on the women's side, it was complete opposite. It was the new coach bringing three of the transfer students.
So, wow.
So. But on the women's side, you know, I this is going to be a whole new team, and they're coming in with some fire and some attitude, and I think they're going to be a fun team to watch.
Well, I know the fans are really looking forward to it, and you're right. It is going to be very much a new-look women's basketball team this season. What was that like, though, for these transfers?
So the three we talked to, really interesting stories. One of them is Jaden Owens. She's a grad student, transferred from Baylor, point guard.
We won't hold that against her.
I know. She got here as soon as she could, right? So, and then she was joined by Sedona Prince, who is a grad student from Oregon. And Jaden and Sedona actually played together some club ball in high school. So it was kind of interesting hearing their story. Sedona Prince is 6'7 forward. She is a trailblazer. Many are going to remember her story from the NCAA tournament in 2021, when it was the COVID year tournament and the women were not being treated as equally as the men, and she went out and did her TikTok video comparing the weight room and...
Oh, yeah, that went viral.
That went viral. But it has continued to change the women's game because of that. And the way the players look at her, the way the coach looks at her for being that trailblazer, but then also being the presence she is on the court. And she was going into the WNBA until Mark Campbell was announced coming here. And so she withdrew from the WNBA draft, immediately came here. She said it was about 24 hours from the time Mark Campbell was announced, so she knew she was coming to TCU. So she's here to do one more year. And then the third one was a junior guard, Madison Connor, who just transferred from Arizona. Interesting story with her. She is from Chandler, Arizona. She's not the only student athlete at TCU from Chandler, Arizona. We had success with another one on the baseball field, Cole Klecker. And so we were talking about that. And she went to high school with Brock Purdy.
So, talk about a small circle.
Right, exactly. So she's going to be fun to watch too. So.
Yeah, this is going to be a fun year for basketball, for sure. And so we've got an event coming up, though, tomorrow at the Schollmeyer.
Tomorrow is the Schollmeyer Live. It's the kickoff to both the men's and women's basketball season. It's a free event at 8:30, obviously, at the Schollmeyer.
No, you can't beat free.
Can't beat free. Nope. Meet the women's team, meet the men's team, have all sorts of contests. Rick Ross is going to be out there for the entertainment. Students can have a half-court shot to win $1,000, so why not? Spend a Friday night, make $1,000. So
just students. I mean, I might show up if I can get a chance.
Everybody else is welcome. I don't think they're welcome for the half court shots.
Well, so. I tried.
the men will actually have an exhibition game on Monday night against Texas Wesleyan, and the season begins November 6th.
Yeah, it's right around the corner. Definitely looking forward to basketball season this year, but also baseball.
Baseball.
We have exhibitions coming up.
Fall ball is underway. Fall camp is happening until mid November. The team went last week and played down in at Texas State. And then Saturday, they're hosting a free game at Lupton against Sam Houston State. So 12 o'clock.
Yeah, so a lot of good Frog athletics going on right now other than football. And so definitely as fans, come out, support the Frogs. Barry, thank you very much.
Absolutely.
Really appreciate you joining us this week and giving us the update. And that brings us to our special guest this week, Frog fans. will immediately recognize this individual, if certainly not by look, by his voice. Nathan, this is a man who has spent since the 1980s with TCU, and the last 35 years, he is one part of probably the best broadcast team, not only at TCU, but probably in college football history. Let me introduce everybody to Mr. John Denton.
How's everybody doing tonight?
Doing good. John, thank you for joining us tonight. Really appreciate that. And we'll get you another
drink
here. It's okay.
Hey, glad to be here. Thanks for asking me to come. This is a lot of fun.
Well, so at the end of last season, you retire from the broadcast booth, and you make a switch, and you join the Flying T group. Is it a group or a club? Am I getting that right?
Our official name is the Flying T Club.
Which
is TCU's NIL collective. So going back to about this time last year, I'd talked to Brian. I'd talked with Jeremiah. I'd been at TCU almost 18 years on staff. I'd been 35 years on the radio crew, and I told him, I said, I think this is winding down. Both my girls were out of TCU, and I was ready to do something different, and I didn't know what I was going to do. I'd been talking to a local bank about going to work for them as a kind of a business development ambassador, but kind of started looking at retirement options and what that date looks like. And, about this time last year, made the decision, went, talked to Jeremiah, told him what I was going to do. And some of my friends, I've got a couple of friends, I've been around a long time. I've been at TCU since 1980. I've got some friends that are trustees and whatnot. I talked to them about some things. They kind of gave the Flying T Club guys a heads up that I was going to retire from TCU. And at the time, they were trying to figure out what they were going to do, because the three guys, Jeff Patman, Chess Williams, and Brian Harlan, who started the collective, it had gotten big in a hurry. And they all have full-time jobs. So they were looking to hire a full-time staff, and they approached me. We started talking, and my last day at TCU was basically the day of the national championship game, and then mid-February I started with the Flying T Club. So took about a month off, but...
Well, I mean, you certainly have the experience. Well, you started with the Frog Club back in, 2005?
Right.
And at various times with TCU, you were involved with any number of fundraising activities that TCU has had over the years.
Yeah.
And so you slip into this role with the Flying T Club and the NIL. What sort of differences are you seeing with the way that the NIL is currently structured and how you're fundraising now for TCU athletics versus how things were back in the Frog Club days?
Well, when I first got back on campus in 2005, the Frog Club was raising about $3.5 million a year. And really what the Frog Club had to market was not a lot. I mean, you had $100 memberships, and you had football parking. You got to remember back then, I mean, the TCU only had, in 2005, I think they only had 8,000 season ticket seats sold for football, which is hard to imagine.
Predates the old Del Conte plus four.
Right. Exactly. Exactly right. So, the immediate challenge there was, okay, how do you get it from 3 or 3.5 million to 5 or 6 million? And... we started working on that. That was when the old stadium was still there. There were no premium seats. There were no clubs. There were no suites, whatnot. And, over time, with the addition of, the new stadium, once the new stadium was complete, the Frog Club went, we built it up to about $6.5-7 million a year. It went from $7 million in 2011 to, after the new stadium opened in 2012, to almost $15 million because of the license agreements that went with the seats, the suites, all the different things. All of a sudden, Eamon Carter Stadium turned into a money pump for the Frog Club, and now they're probably generating 15, 16, now with the East Side, probably $17 million a year. And so that was a change. I mean, you know, in comparison, I mean, this is really our first year with the Flying T Club with a full operation, a full staff. We're out fundraising. We've got a strategy. We're, you know, out getting after it. We'll raise $6.5 million this year. And that's, you know, if you look, you know, you think back 17, 18 years ago, the Frog Club was doing $3 million. I mean,
yeah, it's quite an increase.
That's, well, and that speaks to not only what's going on at TCU, but what's happened overall in college athletics over the year. It's more. And you have to have the facilities. And granted, you know, I came to TCU at the right time. Nothing other than a lot of luck and really good fortune, because in 2005, that's when the program started, especially football, started to hit another gear. They were heading into the Mountain West Conference from Conference USA. The stadium was a few years away, and then you get the stadium done. Then you redo Daniel Meyer. It becomes Schulmeyer Arena. Then you add on and redo to Lupton. All of a sudden, there's all these amenities there that lend themselves to gifts that are attached to seats, suites in all three locations. Club seats in Schulmeyer basically paid for that renovation. And so you've got all these revenue streams, plus all these programs are suddenly winning. I mean, it was football.
Then Rose Bowl.
Basketball. Rose Bowl is what got us into the Big 12.
Right.
Then baseball.
And the Big East for a short period of time.
Well, we were undefeated and untied in the Big East. Never lost a game. So
you got to love that stat.
Yeah.
Now, that's a good one.
If you ask people that are the accountants at TCU, they'll tell you that it cost a bit to get out of that Big East deal. But that all worked out. And TCU did what it needed to do. And, I mean, a lot of that's got to do with the vision that the Victor Bushini had, and also the aggressiveness of Chris Del Conte, because that was a key component. I mean, he was a businessman, and he's got his hands full down at UT now. But I mean, there's a lot of things that happened because of his savvy and his business acumen that helped TCU take those steps.
So, as far as the NIL goes and the Flying T, I know there's a lot of talk on Capitol Hill about the NIL right now, and possibly government regulation on the horizon and things like this. How is the Flying T kind of positioning itself right now? And more importantly, how is it positioning TCU for the future when it comes to these sort of deals that you see? I mean, you have like groups going out and, you know, buying pickup trucks for the entire football team, for goodness sakes. How are you guys positioning TCU Athletics for the future here?
Well, I mean, I'll first say this. I mean, NIL was it's an industry that didn't exist 3 years ago. I mean, it's still very new, still evolving. There are as many formations or forms of NIL groups as there are schools in the nation. Everybody's doing it differently. Some are employing outside groups. Some are, you know, I mean, TCU is very fortunate. The three guys that started the Flying T Club, I mean, they got after it in the late summer 2021, after the switch got flipped on July 1st of 2021. NCAA said, we're out. They had hundreds, if not thousands, of pending lawsuits. They were like, we're throwing the switch. Y'all go do what you want to do. And really the only guidelines were that, you know, there are certain things you can't promote, certain things you can't do, and it's got to be a separate entity from the university. Really, those were the three guidelines. So we're very fortunate in that, and I think we probably, because they got on it so early, there was a lot of dialogue between the university and the Flying T Club, and I think there's always been pretty much an open line of communication, which helped not only form Flying T Club to what it is today, but also probably the athletic department and us. I mean, I think it helps. Jeremiah Donati and I worked together for years, 10 plus years together. There's a really good relationship component there. We're talking every day. I was on the phone with him today for probably 30 minutes. I mean, it's a very important part of what happens over the next several years in TCU athletics. And I think there's a trust factor there as well, that Jeremiah knows that the athletic department needs us, and we're not going to go rogue on them and go off and do something that will get TCU in trouble. That's the last thing we want to do. But you've got to make it apparent that there is an NIL component at TCU for prospective student athletes to really look at TCU as a viable option to go. And you combine that with the transfer portal, and if you're doing both right, it's a very powerful combination.
Yeah, well, like you mentioned it, I mean, the NIL has become kind of a component of the marketing of the school when it comes to athletics. You also mentioned it is kind of a little bit of like the Wild West out there when it comes to NIL. Everyone's still trying to figure out and get their feet underneath them. Yep. How many of the different NIL groups across the country talk to one another? Do you seek out advice from some of the NIL groups that seem to be successful in one way or the other, or is everyone pretty much playing it close to the vest?
No, I mean, I try to talk to and communicate. I mean, I've talked with the folks at UT, at A&M. Got a meeting next week with the Tennessee NIL group. I mean, and, you know, I was in Waco a couple of weeks ago, talked to the folks with Baylor's group. I think it's, you know, there's not a industry group, you know, we're not going to a convention for, you know, here's all your NIL people. I think eventually you'll probably get to that. But, I mean, I'm interested in knowing what Stanford's doing, what Wake Forest is doing, what Notre Dame's doing, what Vanderbilt's doing. I mean, we need to look at, I mean, there's all these different size schools. And I think, you know, for us, we need to know what the big guys are doing, but we also need to look at people that are outside of our conference that I would consider the peer groups, which are some of those private schools that I just mentioned a moment ago, and share information. And there's some things that we're doing that's not going to work for Vanderbilt, but there's some things that they're doing that might work for us that we haven't looked at. And, you know, we're trying to build a donor base. We're also trying to build a base of corporate support. We're also trying to get creative with wealth managers and banks and people that are doing trust and estate planning. I mean, there are a lot of different sources of revenue out there that can benefit from giving to a 501c3, and we're one of the lucky ones. I mean, our founders and our group found the right people to get involved from a legal standpoint. Flying Tea Club was the fourth NIL group in the nation to gain 501c3 status. And that's a huge, huge thing when you go out and you talk to people that want to give money and support the Flying Tea Club, and you can say, this is a donation, we're going to give you a gift receipt, and you can write it off. That's a huge, huge component.
So is getting nonprofit status kind of a more difficult thing now for NIL groups, or are you seeing that a lot of NIL groups are kind of going for profit?
Well, I can't speak for all of them. I do know that there are some that are operated by some companies that are for profit, but we're a 501c3, and I think for the long term, you know, life and growth of an entity like ours, you've got to have nonprofit status. I mean, that's a huge thing, because while we're not part of TCU, I think a lot of donors look at, okay, I've got X amount of money that I'm going to aim at TCU next year, okay? Even though we're a separate entity, separate 501c3, separate tax ID number, I think we're still under that purple umbrella that a lot of donors look at and go, okay, I've only got so much money to give TCU. I'm going to buy my season tickets, I'm going to do this, and I'm going to give the Flying Tea Club X. And we come across a lot of donors that have made big commitments to TCU, and they're like, well, I've already given to TCU, and I'm tapped out for the next 5 years. I'm going to go, okay, we'll be back. Keep us on your list. But I think to a lot of donors, we're under that umbrella, and it's no different for them from a giving standpoint than if they were given to the Frog Club or giving directly to a facility project at TCU.
Yeah, I think that's very important. And I know that a lot of the donors, when the NIL got started, there were many donors that had already given very large gifts for the run-up, a lot of the things that Del Conte was doing to kind of grow the athletic department, a lot of the facilities that we were talking about earlier. And now that money seems to be kind of coming back around. So like you said, it's going to take a couple of years to finally hit. Speaking, though, of, you mentioned wealth managers as one of the groups you guys have talked to. What sort of support, or is there any support that the Flying Tee Club gives to the athletes that actually receive these payouts as far as being able to help them manage the financial aspects of what the NIL is actually going to give them?
Well, that's a big component of it. And, people on the surface look at NIL and they say, okay, well, you sign these players, you're paying them for their name, image, and likeness, and that's it. Well, from our standpoint, and I think this is the beauty of TCU and also the partnership that we've had with the athletic department and the athletic department's partnership with the Neely School from day one. I mean, when all this went down in 2021, Jeremiah Donati got together with Daniel Pullen, who was the then dean of the Neely School, and said, "We're entering a new frontier here. You're going to have players that are going to be receiving monthly distributions, and how do we make sure that they're educated on banking and setting up bank accounts and taxation, LLCs, if they want to set up LLCs?" And they quickly put together the Neely NIL program that partners the athletic department with the Neely School, and now we're kind of the third leg on that as well. And that the Neely School has an office in the South End Zone complex, and they are there every day. So if student athletes have questions on taxation or what they need to do to set up LLCs, or if they need advice, someone's come at them with an outside opportunity to market themselves, the Neely School is there to help. And that's a huge, huge thing, because, I mean, there's always a backside to any kind of transaction. And what we want to do is make sure that, some of these kids are not only the first in their family to go to college, but some of them are the first in their family to have a bank account. Think about that.
Yeah, so I haven't heard that before, but
there
that is crazy.
A huge educational onus on us and on TCU to make sure these kids understand. So, I mean, we've got resources for them through the Neely School. We have resources for them through the Flying Tee Club. We want to make sure that, because these ambassadors that we have under contract that we're helping, they're contractors, they're not employees. So there's no withholding. So filing their
taxes, it's a bunch of 1099s.
Is a huge, huge deal. So, yeah, there's an educational component. And I think the partnership between athletic department, Neely School, and the Flying Tee Club is huge. And I was on a trip last week raising money out in California, and Daniel Pullen happened to be in L.A. the same night, came to our event and made some great comments in support of what we're doing overall to educate student athletes, but also in support of the Flying Tee Club. Very, very, very important that we work, hand in hand, arm in arm with the university, because, I mean, we are a separate entity, but like I said earlier, to a lot of folks, we're joined at the hip, and we're working together.
Well, and that trust that you mentioned earlier is vital in this particular situation, especially with a lot of the legislation that may be coming down over the next several years. So having that trust that Jeremiah has in the Flying Tee Club, knowing that they have the right guy who has been through not only just obviously what you're seeing in the NIL side, but also you've seen it on the other side of the university when it comes to fundraising in the Frog Club. And I think that moving forward, it sounds like you guys are setting everything up for success. And it's interesting to see how the landscape of the NIL has kind of grown over these last 24 months, really, to be honest with you, to where it is today. So let's take a step back from the NIL talk for a moment, and let's talk a little bit about John Denton, right? So I know a lot of Frog fans, we a lot of us, and I'm speaking just as Gen Xer myself, right? We grew up listening to your voice on the radio, right? In the days where you couldn't get TCU Athletics on TV, you would turn on the radio, and you know, usually back then, if you were close enough, it had to be KTCU, but you would listen and you would hear John Denton on the radio. So you came to TCU, though, in 1980 as a walk-on kicker for the football program. What made you choose TCU?
Well, in high school, I always thought I was going to be a baseball player. I was left-handed. I was a pitcher, played first base as a switch hitter. Thought, you know, if I'm going to do anything in college, it's going to be on the baseball diamond. And I really believed that until my junior year in high school, when I was still pretty much just a baseball player. And I'd played soccer, and I'd kicked some in junior high and whatnot. And guy that I played that I knew in high school, who was our kicker, got his leg broken on a kickoff.
Wow.
So
on a kickoff?
Yep. Got nailed anyway. Long story short, at my high school, Bishop Dunn High School in Dallas, they made an announcement that Coach Henderson's looking for a kicker for the football team, and if you can kick, go see Coach Henderson. So this was in homeroom during announcements, you know how it is, early in the day. And
you wanted to get out of a course.
My homeroom teacher was Sister Mary Bryan Bowl, who was tough, okay? She was tough. Old school nun, very tough. So I raised my hand, and she says, "Yes, Mr. Denton." I said, "I just heard that announcement. They said, if you can kick, go see Coach Henderson." And she says, "Can you kick?" I said, "I can kick." She says, "Get your butt down there." So literally.
Wait, was that a direct quote from the sister?
I believe it was, yeah. Okay. She Sister Mary Bryan was not afraid. She didn't get much more off color than that, but. Anyway, I started kicking my junior year in high school, started figuring out I was much better at that, and I also got into punting and still love baseball, but figured out at the college level, I'm probably not going to be able to hit breaking balls that are going to be presented. So decided my senior year, I'd start sending my stat packets out to selected schools that had juniors or seniors that were place kickers. So sent it to Baylor, sent it to Tech, sent it to Colorado. They weren't very good back then. TCU, SMU, I don't know, a handful. Anyway, kind of, early on, kind of like huddle type stuff, you know, it's all video and all that.
Yes.
Well, as it turns out, I got a letter back from Texas. I sent one to Texas. They said, yeah, if you want to come walk on, there's going to be a walk-on day. There's going to be 150 kickers. And Texas Tech, same type thing. And the only school that called was TCU. I'd gotten home from a baseball game early 1980. Phone rang. I'm eating dinner. And my mom answers the phone, and it's F.A. Dry on the phone, who was the head coach at TCU. Said, see, you got admitted to TCU. If you want to come over on a visit and take a look around, that's great. Set up the visit, went over there, met some of the players, and oddly enough, Ron Parker, who is now a TCU trustee, was the director of recruiting back then. Met with him, met some of the players, he showed me around, and when I got done, I went home, I was like, I think this is the only place that wants me, that'll give me a chance, so that's where I ended up coming in 1980, walked on, spent all of 1980 as a flanker on the offensive scout team, getting absolutely beat to hell. And I figured out real quick that if I wanted to get off of that, and Coach Dry gave me he said, if I can travel you and you can punt, kick, and you can also hold for placements, I can get you off that scout team. So I went to work in the fall, in the summer, spring and summer of 81, working toward that goal, made the travel squad in 81, ended up playing 81 through 84. And, you know.
You earned a scholarship, too.
Got put on scholarship and had a great time, great career. And, I mean, great things happened to me at TCU. That's why I loved it so much. Was lucky enough to be on a pretty good team in 84 that we really should have won the Southwest Conference. Didn't quite get there, but, you know, when you think about it, I mean, my 5 years at TCU, we won 15 games total. And eight of those was in 1984 when we went to the Bluebonnet Bowl. So you take the other 4 years and divide those into seven wins, and that kind of tells you where TCU football was back in the day.
Yeah, we've talked to a lot of your former teammates, and it was obviously the 80s were one of those kind of eras where TCU was struggling a lot. And that Bluebonnet Bowl, you know, that was a mark in the 80s that I think a lot of TCU fans were really excited about. And I know for me personally, it was the first time that I had heard TCU growing up in the DFW areas when actually they made the Bluebonnet Bowl. But before then, you're right. I mean, seven wins over the course of, you know, three or four seasons. It kind of reminds me a little bit about the earlier days in the 90s, right outside of the Southwest Conference. So you went to TCU as a broadcast journalism major, is that right?
Yeah, I was. It wasn't the Schieffer School then. It was the School of Communication, and you didn't really have a broadcast major. You could jump into some things at KTCU, and you could do some things in the TV studio, but there
like
really
what,
wasn't
radio, TV, film, or
yeah,
something
it was
like that, right?
RTVF. That's right. What my degree is in, and you kind of had to find ways if you wanted to do broadcast work, and the only opportunity was doing TCU baseball on KTCU, and there were a lot of great thing was it a lot of fun people in the RTVF program back then, but there weren't a lot of people that wanted to do games on radio or be true, you know, play-by-play people. So I raised my hand, went to work at KTCU, and then my freshman year in 1981, spring, I found myself doing TCU baseball games from the old TCU Diamond on KTCU. I'm sure no one was listening. I mean, hopefully they weren't, because I'm sure I was awful back then. But
I ended up
doing it for five springs, 81 through 85. So I learned a lot about how to self-engineer, how to kill time.
Well, because it was just you in the box.
For a lot of it, it was.
Wow.
It's just me. I'd go through major league standings. We'd start talking about spring football. I mean, baseball is about talking to yourself. You better be a really good storyteller, or you've got to have a lot of stuff stacked between pitches just to kill time. But that's where I really learned the art of kind of glamping and just kind of killing time, because there are games both in basketball and football where they're a wipeout one way or the other. And that's where broadcasters really earn their money, especially on radio, because you're not wrapped up in every single play if it's 56-3, one way or the other. You're trying to kill time and make it easy or make it interesting.
Well, in that particular case, you cut your teeth doing baseball games your entire time while you're getting your degree at TCU. At what point in time did you join the broadcast booth? Because you spent, 35 years broadcasting TCU football, mm-hmm. right?
Yep.
When did you first meet Brian Estridge?
I first met Estridge in the summer of 98. They had just, in January, had hired Eric Hyman from the University of Miami in Ohio, and Brian was his play-by-play guy and marketing director. So Eric brought a lot of his staff from Miami of Ohio, and Brian had a couple of options. He went and interviewed for a couple of other jobs, but ended up at TCU. So it was the summer of 98, and he was the director of broadcasting and the director of marketing. I mean, he had dual role within the athletic department, and there was a lot of work that needed to be done. TCU had been understaffed, and really when Eric Hyman came in, I give him credit because he modernized the athletic department. They gave him a lot of funding,
completely
staff
overhauled
up
everything
and changed a lot of things, which needed to happen if TCU was going to start on this path through, you know, the WAC and Conference USA and, you know, Mountain West and then on. So, I mean, I give him credit for that. But, yeah, Estridge called me one day. I'd been on the radio crew at that point about 10 years. I started in 88 and went and had a meeting with him, and he kind of showed me his vision. And, I mean, there were going to be some television components because back then you still had Tier 3 rights that schools could produce their own television broadcast for, I think, up to 3 football games, because the current TV contract at the time with ESPN or whoever the WAC had left holes. To your point,
oh, yeah,
not every
absolutely
game was on television. So, you know, you had to have some ways to cover there. And then there were up to like 10 basketball games a year that the school could produce. So he was going to work TV, but he was also going to support us. And he was actually doing sidelines that first year or two for football radio broadcast. Me and a guy named Bill Coates were doing the games. And then in 2000, Brian moved into the role, and we'd worked together ever since. But, I mean, things changed. I mean, he really modernized the operation and you know, took what we had done. Once we got into the WAC and were done with the Southwest Conference, you know, we'd set up. In fact, a couple of years I had worked. I was basically like the Learfield of TCU. We went out, we set up a 12-station network, got some guys that I knew from the old Southwest Conference network to help us from an engineering standpoint. And pretty much if you were on an interstate highway anywhere in Texas, you could hear our games, which was a leap ahead. But we were way underfunded. When Brian got here and Eric got here, there was a lot more funding, and Brian really took the network and modernized it and made it what it is today.
Well, in 35 years of being a broadcaster for TCU, you, at the end of last season, you retire basically on the day of the national championship game. What did last season mean to you as a culmination of everything that you saw going back to the days of 1980 as a walk-on kicker,
yeah,
winning only 7 games until you get to your Blue Bonnet Bowl season,
yeah,
seeing the end of the Southwest Conference, the TCU moving from conference to conference, kind of like wandering the wilderness of college football, right? To finally see that happen, TCU is the first Big 12 team to win a college football playoff and gets a shot at the national championship game on the day you retire. What did that mean to you last season?
Well, I mean, I think it means everything. I mean, you look back through a lens of 35 years or, you know, in that my case, I mean, got at that point last year, 42 and a half years from the day I first hit campus as a walk-on. And, I mean, I think what it meant to me was, you know, TCU had arrived. TCU was finally what I always knew it could be. Now, there were a lot of things that happened last year that went TCU's way, but, I mean, there are a lot of things over the last 35 or 40 years that happened that were kind of bricks in the wall that kept building. And, you know, I mean, it was a heartbreaker to lose the Big 12 championship game last year. I mean, you're 3 feet away from knocking it in, but still were able to get to the playoff and then beat Michigan and get there. I mean, I think it was kind of a testament to what it takes and how long it takes, and also how long the university and the athletic department, you've got to be committed. I mean, it's one of those deals where you keep playing, you keep swinging, you're going to have your ups and downs. I mean, 04 was a bad season, 13 was a bad season, but, you know, it's like you look at stocks over time. Yeah, you're going to have some dips, but you've got to keep fighting, and you got to keep trying, and you've got to keep recruiting and keep doing the things, and it's a day-to-day grind. And, you know, I mean, yeah, things didn't go the way we wanted it to in L.A., but, you know, as Glenn Stone, who was a longtime SID here at TCU, said to me after we lost to A&M in 84, all we had to do was we had to either beat Texas or A&M. Had to just split one of the last two games to win a share of the conference and go to the Cotton Bowl for the first time in 38 years or whatever it was. We would have played Doug Flutie and Boston College in the Cotton Bowl. And we're all heartbroken. Lose to A&M, get that close and blow it. And he said, look, you got to get there to lose it. And I thought of him the day that we were in L.A. when we were, you know, middle of the third quarter. That game was over. And I thought about him. And I also drew on my experience of working blowout baseball games back in 1983 because that's when you go to the back of the chart book and you start figuring out, okay, what are we going to talk about? Let's talk about next year. Let's talk about spring ball. Let's talk about, you know, at that point you turn a game into a talk show. But to me, I mean, it meant everything. I mean, I did this thing called Denton's Do's and Don'ts right before the kick. For the last, Estridge invented that back in 98.
So oh, that was an Estridge thing.
So, yeah.
We love those.
We're going to do keys to the game. We're going to call them Denton Do's and Don'ts. Okay, fine. And I will say, I told you guys earlier, only cried two other times on the air. That was at the end of the Sun Bowl in 98, which, I mean, that game is what really was the launch pad
absolutely
for
amazing.
What's happening now. The Rose Bowl in Pasadena. But it was hard to get the words out. Back at SoFi Stadium, John Denton here with Denton's Do's and Don'ts for the national championship game. Mm. And if you go back and you listen to that audio, you'll hear me go. On the do's side for the Frogs, I mean, I had to kind of pull it together because, you know, to have played on a 1-10 team in 1980, and here you are going for the national championship.
Right.
You know, at that point, ball wasn't in the air yet, and we didn't know we were going to get beat by 57 points or whatever it was. I mean, it's pretty cool. And I believe we're going to get back there again, and it'll be a different outcome.
I agree with you. I think that absolutely 100% right, but I think that's amazing. That quote is going to stick with me for a very long time. You got to get there. Of all the years that you have been broadcasting, the baseball games, we haven't even talked about basketball, and all the – shoot, you did 417 football games. Can't even imagine how many basketball games at this point. What was your absolute favorite memory with Brian Estridge in the broadcast booth?
Oh, gosh. I mean, man, we've had a lot of great wins. I mean, there's a lot of high-fiving and punching one another. I mean, there's a lot of things that – you never see or hear on the air, but I mean, we're very close. We're almost like family. I mean, we hit it off from day one. We've spent a lot of time together on the road, on and off the air. We're at Cincinnati in 04 working a game, and Brian's wife goes into labor. My wife drove her to the hospital, and we're flying back on the charter, and Brian's, you know, little beside himself. We jump in his truck from Meacham and haul it down there. Fortunately, he got there before Gaines was born. But, you know, my two daughters are TCU grads now. Gaines Estridge, who was born that next day, is now a freshman pitcher at Air Force. I mean, we've lived a chunk of our lives together. And we've had a lot of fun. We've had our disagreements off air. You know, we sometimes have seen games different ways, but I mean, it's like family. You get over it and you move on, but we've had a lot of fun, a lot of great calls. I mean, the two Alamo Bowls, you couldn't have had more fun. You talk about games where you feel like you're just getting poured into a blender. You get lost in those games. Rose Bowl was similar. The Boise game in 11. I mean, I could go on and on and on where we're punching one another. Baylor game last year.
The bazooka.
Oh, the bazooka kick. I mean, there are just so many things that happen. And, you know, I think for the most part, I don't think we ever homered it up. But if you listen, you could tell who we work for and who we want to have win.
Absolutely.
And I think that's a testament to, I mean, there was a certain level of professionalism that we knew needed to happen in the booth. Never going to hear Brian or I say us or we or them or, I mean, hell, we're not playing. I mean, we're not putting a hand down. I mean, it's the Frogs and it's whoever. It isn't we or us. I mean, it's, you know, there's a certain detachment as a broadcaster that you've got to have, because, I mean, I think if you're a homer, it devalues what you're doing, and that's something that he and I always worked on and always prided ourselves in. But we've had a lot of fun, and I'll tell you one of the funniest things, off, really doesn't have anything to do with play-by-play, but we're up at Northwestern. It's probably 2002 or 2000, might have been 2000. And we're playing, and we're in the middle of the game. Ty Gunn is the quarterback. And Northwestern's press box had these big gulp cups, but they had no lids and no straws. So, you know, you got this big gulp cup. I put mine on the floor, much like here tonight. Estridge had his up on the counter, and he's got on khaki pants, and he gets his headset cord wrapped around, and he pulls away, and bam, pulls that big gulp cup of Pepsi or whatever, goes all over. So the next play, it's a pass play, and the play-by-play goes something like this. While the stuff is pouring all over him, he says, spilled the play before this. Here's Gunn rolling out, looking to his right, rolling. All the time he's calling the play, he's got the belt off. He's getting the pants off. He's down to his socks and his underwear as he calls the play. Says, oh, my God, he got loose, got to the 5-yard line, got the first down. John, what about that? I said, that was a hell of an escape. And nobody knew what I was talking about. They thought I was talking about Ty Gunn. And then the next play, first and goal at the 5 for the Frogs, blah, blah, blah. There's a handoff. He is laying, they had this monitor rack out in the sun in front of the booth, lays his pants out there to dry, and does the rest of the first half in his underwear in the booth. At one point, Malcolm Loudon, one of our biggest donors, walks in because he liked to hide in the booth. Then comes Eric Hyman, and they're like, what in the world is going on? We got a pretty good chuckle out of that. Not a lot of listeners knew about it, but now they all do.
Oh, that is fantastic.
Well, sorry to stumble through the story, but I can still see it right now. He got out of those pants while he's calling a play, and I thought that was a hell of an escape.
That is a hell of an escape. Well, John, we really appreciate you coming on tonight. And
well, thanks for having me on. I mean, y'all do a great job. Y'all have been in it a long, long time. And my hat's off to KillerFrogs.com and my old teammate, Scotty Mack, who's no longer with us. But, Lord, I was having a discussion with some of our other teammates the other day. I mean, Scott Nix was so in, all in on it. Can you imagine him in the NIL era?
Oh, no. I was just thinking about that driving in today.
That'd be another, you know, pepper on the plate of nachos there. He would have gone off the launch pad. But anyway, y'all do a great job. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Thank you, John. Appreciate it. Yeah. Well, Nathan, you know, we're about, 45 minutes in today, and I know we had a game, if you want to call it that, on Saturday.
Someone had a game. K-State had a game.
K-State definitely had a game. Fortunately, Frogs lose 41-3. And enter the bye week at 4-4 on the season. And there's not – you know, I really appreciate Clint's videos on YouTube. I don't know if you saw this last week's one.
I didn't know.
It was just Clint sitting down on his couch saying to the camera, all right, it's time for me to enjoy my favorite football. And then all it is a nuclear explosion. End of video. That was it. That was the total thing. And I have to admit, I think talking about this game kind of puts me in that same mood. I don't necessarily want to relive and rehash the entire game. But moving forward in this season, do you think the Frogs get to 6 wins?
I think it's very doable. It obviously depends on what team shows up every week. But I think we can, you know, handle business with Tech. I think we can handle business with Baylor. Honestly, I think we have a chance at beating Texas if we play our best game.
Really?
I do.
Okay.
They don't have Quinn Ewers, and, you know, we seem to always play well against Texas. The only bad game we've played against them was in 2013 when we had the three-hour weather delay. Other than that, I mean, they've been either close games or we've dominated them. So I think they're very winnable games. Obviously, I'm not going to get ahead of myself like I did last week. But I think we can get to a bowl game. I don't know who we would play, what bowl we would make, but I'm hoping for the player's sake we can get to a bowl game.
Yeah, and as a former player, how important is that at this point in the season? Because you played on a couple of seasons where things went really, really well, and some things didn't. How, at this point in the stage in the season, what do you think is going through these players' heads?
Make a bowl game. That's honest, it? Yeah, I think at this point, you want to obviously fix what's going wrong. You want to get ahead of that. Whether some players are taking it seriously right now, who knows? We can't see that side of the team being where we're at. But first things first, you obviously want to win, take care of the games that you can take care of. Get to that bowl game, get the bowl gifts, all that stuff, travel, see the city that you're going to, have fun, hang around football just a little bit longer, especially for the seniors that are about to head out. You know, you want to get to a bowl game and be able to spend a little more time in the program and to really take advantage of what they have going on for them.
Yeah, they're another day in the sun, so to speak.
Yeah, and so those that year, you know, it was – the year we went to play Georgia in the Liberty Bowl – it was Coach P's message was, you know, hey, let's just have the best season we can for the seniors because they're about to leave. They're never – a lot of them probably never going to play football again. Let's just have the best season we can for them.
Well, hopefully coming back after this bowl game, we have a Thursday night game against Texas Tech, and we'll have an announcement about that day here in just a little bit. Getting to six wins, though, for this team I think would be important. But at this point in time, what do you think the major issues are moving forward that the coaching staff has to address?
I think you got to find a way to get them prepared for every game, whether it's watching the film. Well, obviously they're in film every day, but you have to get them prepared to be able to handle what's going to be thrown at them. We've seen that when TCU has time to do that, they usually do pretty well. But on the flip side, you also got to prepare them emotionally. You got to do a good job of firing them up. Just last week, we just felt so dead, and at that point, it's like,
it's kind of like the Colorado game almost.
Yeah, I think it was even worse because you're in the middle of the season. You've got things going for you. Some weeks you do, some weeks you don't. We just came off a big win against BYU. You should have had momentum. You should have had energy coming into that game, and we just came out flat. I don't know what happened. I don't know if we just weren't mentally prepared or focused all week. I don't know. But I feel like that part is more on the coaches of saying, hey, we got to be ready for this game.
Yeah, and you bring up a good point. Having time to be able to prepare for Texas Tech, I think, is going to be important for this particular team. But I am a little concerned, going back to the maturity of this particular team and what we're seeing. I mean, there are reports that were happening that, you know, after you're down three or four scores, you got guys on the sideline laughing, you know, when they're playing Kansas State. I know the fans really don't like to hear that kind of thing. The problem that we've discussed earlier on in the season was kind of a lack of leadership. And I think last week, seeing what Hoover was able to do and seeing what the both the defense and the offense kind of rallied around him, kind of reminiscent a little bit about what – I'm not necessarily, you know, comparing Hoover to Duggan, but we saw a little bit of that last year after, you know, Chandler goes out and Max comes in. We saw that last week against BYU. Do you think that this team is just a little immature, or do you think it's just falls on the heels of, or on the shoulders really, of the coaching staff just not getting them prepared?
I think it's a little bit of both. I think when you lose that many seniors after a very historic run for us, a lot of people want to come in and take advantage of that situation. They haven't been a part of the grind to get there, and so they come in expecting immediate success. And so, and I'm not blaming any particular player in this situation, but they come in expecting a certain amount of success, and when you don't get it, you're kind of like, check out. And it's like, oh, well, this wasn't what it was. This wasn't what I thought it was.
Yeah, the motivation's gone.
Yeah, and their kind of motivation's gone. So then you lose those guys. And then the guys who were kind of coming up, younger guys starting to play a little more, get starts, whatever it is, they, you know, get frustrated. And because those guys aren't buying in, we don't have that leadership to kind of bring everybody together and say, hey, guys, like, you know, the season's not over. We have four more games. Like, we got to play well. Last week should have been, you know, we have five more games. But it's just, I think everybody from a different perspective just kind of takes advantage of the situation of last year. And so I think that's why, and even fans, you know,
so a bit of a hangover situation.
Yeah, so a lot of our newer fans, you know, they're used to TCU doing that. And that's just not always the case. Like, and John kind of mentioned it with when you play for the team, whether you're a player, athletic trainer, band, cheerleader, you've committed time to this program. And so when you have seasons like that, it means so much more. But even when you don't have seasons like that, when you have seasons like 2013, this year, where things just aren't going well, you're still invested and it still means a lot more to you than I would say other people don't understand. And so for me, I'm going to watch the whole game because there's just something about watching TCU football that just gets me invested. I love the school. I bleed purple. But even when things aren't going great, like, I'm still going to be behind this team. Yeah, I'm frustrated. I want them to play better, but it's a frustration of connection. Like, hey, stop being stupid, do better. Like, what are you doing?
Right.
But I haven't given up on TCU. A lot of the newer fans, I feel like, are kind of coming out of the woodwork of saying, oh, well, like, they're wanting to throw everybody under the bus. I'm like, it can't be rainbows and sunshine all the time. You're going to go through bad times, and that makes the good times sweeter, like when, you know, John's calling a national championship game.
Yeah, well, and I think John brought up a good point, too. I mean, he was equating it to kind of like a stock tracker, right? If you look over the historical aspect of a stock, you know, you have these dips, you have these valleys, you have these peaks. And certainly TCU has had more peaks lately than they've had valleys. But, you know, you get to this point in the season, I think a lot of fans right now are just kind of questioning things. Like, how do you go from playing in a national championship game to now suddenly looking at a 4-4 season and questioning about whether or not you're even going to make a bowl game? And there were several. I mean, Clemson, for instance, right after being in the national championship game, they had a really down season. There are a lot of times where things like that actually happen. It'll be interesting to see how the Frogs actually bounce back now that they've had some time off, moving into the Texas Tech game on a Thursday night, having to travel actually out to Lubbock. And you know, AT&T Stadium out in Lubbock is not exactly the easiest place to play in the Big 12.
It's terrible. It's it's terrible. It's not a fun place to go. Lubbock is just...
Well, nobody wants to go to
it's
Lubbock.
It's just Lubbock.
Right.
That's all I have to say.
Yeah. I think one of my favorite, you know, John brought up Scott Nix. One of my favorite things that we used to do, that Scott used to do, is at the beginning of every season, there is a kind of a media day where you get to actually meet the football team. And you've got different members of the football team kind of spread out around the Four Stevens room, and you get the chance to kind of ask them different questions. And, of course, all the journalists, they're always asking these various questions like, oh, you know, hey, you know, tell us about the offensive line, or what did you do in the offseason? You know, how do you think your wide receiver core is going to be, and blah, 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 blah. Scott would always get in there and would always ask these, like, crazy late-night talk show questions. And one of my absolute favorite ones that didn't get a chance to make the air was he was asking them, you know, Which one would you, you know, what was it? It was basically he was equating Lubbock to the dark side of the moon, right? And he was getting these football players basically to kind of rag on the fact that they had to go to Lubbock versus, you know, they would rather go to the dark side of the moon than go to Lubbock. And the SID basically asked us to cut that out. It was like, can you just kind of remove that? So, yeah, even back when you were playing, the players did not exactly appreciate having to go to Lubbock.
No, it's a place you are told don't take your helmet off.
Oh, well, that's good advice.
Yeah, it's just one of those places. You know, if you're winning, it's going to be hostile. They're going to probably throw stuff. If you're losing, they're probably going to throw stuff. They like to throw things in Lubbock and
yeah,
sneak tortillas in places.
Well, it's not the tortillas that you're worried about them throwing at you, unfortunately.
It's the frozen batteries.
Yeah, well, yeah, and I think going back to back in the 90s when I was at TCU when we played Oklahoma and we beat Oklahoma there on the road, it was the same situation. You're really surprised by what fans actually throw at people on the field. So it is what it is. Well, you know, talking about the game in Lubbock next Thursday night, do want to announce this will be our episode 200 show. We'll be next week on Thursday, and we are going to have a watch party. So for anybody in Fort Worth, you know RAR Brewery. Everybody loves RAR. Everyone loves Fritz. Great supporters of TCU Athletics and TCU over the years. So we're going to have a watch party at RAR Brewery. And you come on down. We're going to have a pregame show. Nathan, Shannon, and I will be up there. We're going to try to do John and Brian Proud. We're not going to do play-by-play, but we will certainly make the media timeouts a little bit more manageable. And we're also going to be releasing our first seltzer in conjunction with RAR. So come on out. We got frog water for y'all. You can try that. And doors, I believe, open at 5:30 that day. Game's going to start at 6. And we're going to have the game on, multiple TVs. Of course, we're going to have beer. We're going to have live entertainment. It's going to be a fun time for episode 200.
Hey, whether the frogs are playing good or bad, we're going to have a good time. That's all that matters.
We'll certainly have the beer to make it a good time. That's for sure. Well, with that, I think we have come to the end of the podcast tonight. I want to thank everybody who's out there listening to us. Of course, you can find Killer Frogs on all the major podcast channels. You can find us on Apple, Google Play. We're even on Amazon and Spotify now. And go to killerfrogs.com. Go ahead and sign up for a free account. Let us know what you think is going to happen next week against Texas Tech. And with that, I think we have come to the end of the podcast. Nathan, thank you for joining us. I want to thank our special guest, John Denton, for this week's podcast. It's the time of the podcast where we get our frogs up and we get to say,
Go Frogs!
Go Frogs.